Chapter 25. The Jarapha Home Fleet star carrier, you should have thought of that before we left home, slipped through the Elder Wormhole that allowed access to the world called Paradise, or Gitanu, or Pradasis, or what the fuck ever. The star carrier's crew could not care less what name that lonely world was tagged with. All they cared about was getting rid of the only ship currently on their hardpoints, a troop ship they picked up at Earth. Their annoyance was not with the humans, though those beings were polite and agreeable and inoffensive to the point where every crew member aboard the star carrier just wanted to smack them silly. No, their annoyance was directed at the lucky bastards who ran the "We Avoid Temptation, But It Keeps Finding Us." Those assholes just could not shut up about the awesome action they found on Earth and how they couldn't wait to get back. Did some crew members of the star carrier apply for transfer to the troop ship? Yes. Were their applications accepted? Sadly, there were no crew slots available aboard the Temptation. Did some of the star carrier's crew sneak aboard the troop ship anyway, hoping to hide until their mothership jumped away? Also, yes. Did any of the would-be stowaways succeed? No. The agitated crew remaining aboard the star carrier were determined that if they could not get shore leave on Earth, none of their jackass crewmates would either. The stowaways were located and dragged back to their assigned ship, protesting they had religious or medical or family reasons for going to Earth. Their protests were ignored. So it was with one grumpy and one gleefully boastful crew that the star carrier transitioned through the event horizon, quickly verifying its location based on sighting several distinctive stars in that area of the galaxy. The "you should have" coasted forward, away from the wormhole that soon would be closing behind it on its ancient and unchangeable schedule. As the ship's sensors recovered from the space-time distortion, they noted a possible anomaly. A gravimetric reading where there should not be one. Space around that emergence point had been scanned and mapped carefully less than 2 months prior. No navigation hazards were noted, and it was light years from any star system. The ship's AI was just bringing the curiosity to the attention of the biological crew when 6 stealthy Maxulx missiles slammed into the star carrier's still energizing shields, their hardened nose cones surviving to penetrate the thin armor plating of both star carrier and the attached transport ship. The missiles exploded just before a Maxulx cruiser and 2 destroyers dropped their own stealth fields and accelerated to pass through the wormhole in the opposite direction. When the event horizon winked out, the Paradise End was awash with the cloud of a new and rapidly cooling nebula. The Rindaloo battleship Hammer of Epthelion appeared without warning just beyond the outer radius of the strategic defense network of the Jarapha world. The planet Garshamel was the hub for fleet operations in the sector and the most frequent contact point on the rare occasions when the Rindaloo wished to speak directly with their clients. Following long-established protocols, the Rindaloo sent a brief message proposing a meeting at a military space station, then they settled down to wait. The Jarapha they knew would not reply immediately. The arrival of a senior species battleship, even one operated by a presumably friendly species, had set off alarms in the local strategic defense network. It also, more importantly, set off a wild flurry of wagering activity on and around the planet as the local inhabitants tried to guess the purpose of their patrons visiting unexpectedly. The Rindaloo found the compulsive gambling of their clients to be inexplicable, if amusing. And they also knew there wasn't anything they could do to hurry the process along. Demands for a faster response would only be met with claims of technical difficulties or that the appropriate authorities were busy doing important things. When the Central Wagering Office announced that betting was absolutely, finally, okay, we will allow a few last-second transactions to be registered, closed, the Rindaloo stopped doing whatever it is that Rindaloo do and waited for a response, which came only moments later. For every Jarapha on and around the planet was waiting impatiently to see if they had been right about the purpose of the visit. A rather large and imposing dropship departed from the Hammer of Epthelion and docked aboard the space station. To the frustration of the Jarapha, their patrons insisted on a long, tedious ceremony to open the meeting, while their counterparts used every bit of their self-control to not scream at their patrons to get to the freaking point. When the spiders finally stated the purpose of the meeting, there was alarm, consternation, disappointment, and jubilation among the Jarraptha officials, depending on how they had wagered. Also, when they paused to think about it later, the meeting might have a serious effect on not only their society, but the entire galaxy. The Rindaloo had not issued demands or threats, not openly. What they did was to state simply and in a matter-of-fact manner that if the Jarraptha continued to pursue an alliance with the upstart humans, the mutual defense treaty between Rindaloo and Jarraptha would be considered null and void. Basically, the Jarraptha would be defenseless against attacks by the Maxalks coalition, including by the Maxalks themselves, unless the humans could protect them. The humans, who currently had a total of 2 operational starships. The Jarraptha had much to think about. But first, they had something much more important to do. Wagers needed to be placed on the subject of what decision their government would make. General Bailey knocked on Lynn Bessenson's office door. He didn't lean casually on the doorframe the way he did for a social call, and he wasn't smiling. General Bessenson was hunched over her laptop, adding to an already too long briefing for the incoming UNEF personnel. She needed to cut it down to a manageable size right after she added in a bunch of important things she had remembered that morning. "Temptation is overdue," Bailey announced cryptically. Lynn looked up with a blank stare. A glance at the clock projected on the wall showed it was still 2 hours before noon, but Bailey had been in the field, and his body might be operating in a different time zone. She reached into a drawer and pulled out a bottle of rum that was distilled in southern Lemuria. It tasted like it was made in a bathtub, but it was rum, not the fake alcohol provided by the Ruhar or the moonshine soldiers cooked up.
"It's a little early for temptation, but you're welcome to it."
She held out the bottle. Bailey shook his head. "The ship. The transport bringing in the UNEF survey team is called the Temptation. Something like that." Bezenson's lips formed a silent O.
"I didn't know that. It's not officially overdue," she noted. "That ship was 7 days late for its scheduled arrive date, but interstellar travel was variable, especially when star carriers were one of the variables. The carrier could have been diverted, or one of the other ships it was supposed to rendezvous with could have been delayed. Also, if the schedule was thrown off for any reason, the star carrier might have to change where it went through an Elder wormhole, waiting for hours or days at an emergence point. There was also a strong possibility that confusion and bickering by the United Nations over who to include in the survey team could have delayed the departure from Earth. The Ruhar were upset that the ship had launched at all. Their announcement of banning any new humans from landing on Paradise came after the Jarraptha ship had already departed for the flight to Earth.
"The hamsters are worried," Bailey said quietly, looking both ways along the hallway.
"Unofficially."
Shit.
The rule was a ship was not declared overdue for 10 standard days, that is, 10 days on the Ruhar homeworld, about 10.5 days on Paradise.
"They're worried because of the time? Or do they know something?"
"A Jarraptha star carrier came inbound through the local wormhole 2 days ago. It noticed a gas cloud near one of the other emergence points of that wormhole, a cloud that wasn't there 3 weeks ago. The star carrier couldn't divert to investigate. It was on a priority mission. Could be nothing, but the Beatles are sending a warship to investigate."
300 people, she said softly, aghast at the thought.
300 humans.
Bailey looked at the ceiling, reminding her that aliens could be listening.
Plus the crew of the transport, the star carrier, and any other ships it had attached. Lynn, if this was an attack, the UNEF people might only have been collateral damage.
She looked at him, and he stared back. Neither of them believed what he had said could be true. Paradise was still a backwater world. There had been little fighting in the area other than the Ruhar and Kristang contesting for control of the planet. It made no sense that peer enemies of the Jarraptha would travel such a distance to strike one star carrier.
"When will we know?"
"The Ruhar liaison officer to the Jarraptha thinks we'll have an answer within 3 days. The Beatles are worried, too, if this affects their potential deal with us."
I understand. Yes, I will. Thank you. Lynn Besenson waited for Administrator Logelia to end the call, then tucked the phone back in a pocket. Standing up from her office chair, she took a breath to compose herself. In a corner of the office was a box that contained the personal items she was bringing back to Earth. She tapped it with a foot on her way out the door. In the hallway, she could hear voices coming from a conference room at the far end. A meeting had ended, and people were talking loudly, laughing, joking. Sticking her head in the open doorway, she saw a dozen people, including Generals Bailey, Ling, and Kumar. Bailey was laughing at something Kumar had said, his mouth frozen open when he saw Besenson. Everyone stopped talking to stare at her. The Burgermeister. She paused to swallow. Just called me, as a courtesy. A Jarattha ship investigated that cloud near the local wormhole. It's a debris field.
Shit, Bailey breathed.
The Beatles found a damaged flight recorder buoy. It's from the star carrier that was bringing the UN survey team here. General Kumar asked,
Do they know?
The chemical composition of the debris field contained traces of osmium and tantalum that are signatures of a Maxalx missile. They want everyone to know who destroyed those ships. The room was silent. The Maxalx and Rindaloo had been applying escalating levels of diplomatic pressure and thinly veiled threats against species who were considering an alliance with Earth. Now an apex species had struck a direct blow against humans. Bailey said what everyone was thinking.
So it begins.
Everything at Jaguar was going well. Ahead of schedule, actually. True, UNEF heavily padded the schedule because we didn't know the condition of the ships we would be getting or the exact capabilities of the fleet support ships. It was not quite true that we were totally clueless about the first batch of ships because Skippy watched activity of the Beatles' central wagering office. He saw that the smart money, wagers by people closely associated with the project to deliver the first batch of ships to us, were overwhelmingly betting that we would accept 90% of the ships. That was a good forward indicator that the Jarattha were not planning to screw us by delivering a bunch of useless crap. So, we had high confidence going in. Still, Skippy bitched and moaned so much about how difficult it would be to convert obsolete ships into something useful that the leaders of UNEF Command were careful about getting their hopes up. Plus, there was a whole lot of stuff that could go wrong, and until we took that first batch of ships through the wormhole to Jaguar, I privately feared the kiddies, or spiders, or both, would try to interfere. For once, my fears were for nothing. I'm totally okay with that. I was also totally okay with having Sims back aboard for the flight out to Jiayuguan. She had gotten the job done on Earth and was hitching a ride with us. What made me especially happy was that she agreed to act as my temporary XO during the flight. Having to train a new executive officer on every flight was seriously getting on my nerves. It was great having an experienced officer by my side again. We had high confidence that when we arrived at the nearest Jarattha fleet base, the Beatles would be eager to provide a second batch of ships in exchange for us upgrading a batch of ships for them. Why not? They had plenty of time to see what the demonstrator ships could do. Unless they were complete idiots, they had to know the technology advancements we provided were only slightly below the capability of a Maxalx warship. A fleet of ships upgraded to those standards would vault the Jarattha above any top-tier clients in either coalition. Hey, you might ask, were we asking for trouble by giving aliens so much power? What was stopping the Jarattha from using those ships against us? That is a very good question, an issue UNEF wrestled with before agreeing to provide a menu of upgrades the Beatles could choose from. We were only giving them a limited set of technology advancements, and everything we provided was several notches below the technology aboard Valkyrie. Our own ships would have the full suite of every high-tech toy Skippy could stuff into them, and... Anyway, we weren't worried about being double-crossed by the Jarattha. They had too much to gain and too much to lose. So when we jumped into the outer edge of the star system and scanned for trouble, we got a slap in the face. The Beatles, of course, had designated a zone for our arrival, a place that was safe from traffic and free from natural objects floating around that we might smack into while coming through a jump wormhole. Before jumping into the designated zone, we emerged farther away to check for surprises. Uh-oh, Skippy groaned. What the f... We've only been at Jaguar for 5 freaking weeks. How did everything go to shit so fast? Damn it, I leave the galaxy alone for... Skippy. Automatically, I tried to rise from my chair to get a better look at the main display, looking for signs of trouble. That was stupid. If there was trouble looming over our heads, being firmly strapped into my seat was the proper way to deal with it. Chill, please. What are you talking about? What went wrong? Ugh, what hasn't gone wrong? Jeez Louise, I seriously need to babysit the galaxy. The second I turn my back, you meat sacks screw up everything. One step at a time, okay? Okay. He took a breath. I'll go through the list in chronological order. First, the spiders announced that if the Ruhar continued to cooperate with humanity, including allowing humans to occupy portions of Ruhar worlds, the spiders would not honor their mutual defense treaty obligations. Shit. I suddenly felt cold. This is not entirely unexpected, Sims reminded me. Before we left Earth, the pre-mission brief from UNEF Command anticipated there could be pushback from the senior species. We had a list of authorized responses if one or both of the Apex powers tried to intimidate a species we wanted to ally with. Unfortunately, options 1 through 10 on the list of authorized responses required us to fly back to Earth to get revised orders. Right, I agreed. What did the hamsters do? They told UNEF HQ on Paradise that the UN survey team from Earth would not be allowed dirtside. Basically, UNEF needs to get humans off Paradise on an accelerated schedule. I shared a look with Sims, then asked, did the hamsters offer to help with the evac? The discussions didn't get that far as I know. The information I'm getting here is out of date, you understand? Yeah. Information traveled around the galaxy only as fast as ships could carry it. There was a network of relay stations throughout the galaxy, most along the most heavily traveled routes between the most strategically important wormholes. Ships flying along those routes were supposed to swing by relay stations, usually only for a few minutes, to exchange information. Each species had their own relay stations, and often an advanced species would use the relay stations of a lower-level client if that was convenient. The Theranin could store data in a Kristang relay station, knowing the lizards had no possibility of reading the encrypted files. Considering that there was no reliable long-range, faster-than-light communication system available to anyone in the Milky Way, relay stations were a good system, though with some major flaws. Star systems on opposite sides of the galaxy might exchange information faster than star systems within a few light-years of each other if the more distant systems were on heavily traveled wormhole routes. Sometimes a message would be received countermanding a previous order before the original message was available. And always, the information at any one place was out of date and incomplete. I understand that. Do you know what the Ruhar government has decided? They were leaning toward a temporary freeze and allowing humans on their worlds, waiting to see how Earth would respond. But that is OBE. Joe, I am sad to report that the ship carrying the UN survey team to Paradise was destroyed by the Maxalks. What? It's confirmed. Not only did the Maxalks do it, they are bragging about it because humans didn't respond. That is bullshit. We didn't know about it. That doesn't matter. The Maxalks hit us, and we did nothing to retaliate. I noted that Skippy said we. That, at least, was good news. Yeah, well, we'll see about this no retaliation thing. Sir, Sims got my attention. Yes, I know we can't act without clearance from UNEF Command, I snapped at her, irritated. That was unfair of me. She was doing her job. Silently, I mouthed sorry at her, and she nodded. She was as pissed about the situation as I was. Anything else? The news only gets worse, I am afraid, Skippy said. The Rindaloo recently notified the Jarraptha that they also will not be protected by the spiders if the Jarraptha sign an alliance with us. The transfer of a second batch of ships has been put on hold, unfortunately. On hold? Wait, on hold like delay, or like cancelled? The Jarraptha government has not announced a formal policy. However, wagering is running 6-1 against them pursuing any further cooperation with humans. The Maxalks' attack on the UN survey team got everyone's attention. Everyone but us, since we spent the time at the ass end of the galaxy blissfully unaware that the situation was unraveling. Covering my face with a hand, I peeked at him through my fingers. Please tell me you don't have any more bad news. I do have one little item of good news. The Bosphorok took the bait. They captured the Trojan Horse demonstrator ship.
Whoopee freaking do, is what I wanted to say. It would have made Skippy pout if I didn't appreciate him announcing some positive news.
That's better than nothing, I guess.
Crap. We still have a job to do.
Is it safe to proceed to the designated jump-in zone? The situation was a severe test of my diplomatic skills, which, frankly, sucked anyway. The beetles we talked to were polite. They were complimentary about the advanced technology we installed in the demonstrator ships. They were excited and curious about the technology information package we provided and were eager for Skippy to explain what it meant. They also requested that we return the entire first batch of ships they delivered to us. My impression was that request was a formality, so they could tell the Rindaloo that they tried to get the ships back. My reply, also polite, was to say no. We were keeping those ships, and everything else they gave us. Did I make any progress in getting the beetles to loosen their grip on that second batch of ships? No, I did not. There was nothing to do but fly directly back to Earth, so that's what we did. I was wrong again. There was something else we could have done. Should have done. By the time my stupid brain brought the fact to my attention, it was too late.
The two scout ships, one from each of the nominally allied but rival species, jumped in near the star system above the ecliptic and well beyond the orbit of the outermost planet. One of the species had been to that star system before under vastly different circumstances, and not recently enough to have useful knowledge of the local defenses. The scouts were tasked with determining whether the tactical intel provided by their patrons was accurate, that the target planet was virtually undefended. That information was difficult to believe, and both client species noted that their asshole patrons were not risking their own necks in the operation. To the surprise of both scout ship crews, the planet's strategic defense network would not sound an alarm when the warships jumped in, because that planet did not have an SD network. There were satellites in orbit, mostly for communications, bouncing photons to and from the surface for the entertainment of the odd and primitive beings who lived there. Two starships were in orbit. They were both old and no threat even to the scout ships. One had its reactors powered down. The other was running on minimum power while it was apparently undergoing extensive modifications. Unless there was an orbiting constellation of very sophisticated stealth SD platforms, their asshole patrons had actually told the truth. The planet had no effective defenses. Waiting until the last second of their schedule, because neither ship's crew could believe what they had found, the scout ships jumped away at the same time, each emerging near their home star carrier. The two star carriers were surrounded by warships with their guns pointed at their allies, neither side trusting each other at all. Their commanders conferred, analyzing data from the scout ships, also not quite believing what they saw. They would have waited to send out more scout ships if they weren't under a hard time constraint. If they did not attack before the gamma rays of the two scout ships reached the target planet, the beings there would be alerted to the threat and might be able to activate hidden defenses. The operation, being conducted at the insistence of their patrons, was already risky enough. The star carriers and scout ships remained behind, while the warships counted down and disappeared in flashes of gamma radiation. Senior Colonel Chang, the UN Undersecretary for Homeworld Security, closed the laptop with equal measures of annoyance and relief as the jet descended for landing. Automatically, he tugged the lap belt to check it was secure while tucking the laptop into the seat back.
Sir,
the aide seated across the aisle began to say something, but Chang held up a hand. He had so little time to himself. Whatever the man wanted, it could wait. Leaning his head against the window, he tried to get a view of Manhattan, off to the northwest. The plane was coming into JFK Airport, where he would then board a helicopter for a short flight to Manhattan. That evening, there was a UN meeting, preceded by a cocktail reception where all the actual work would get done. His head hurt just thinking about it. standing on aching feet in the reception hall, holding a drink he wouldn't have time to taste, and smiling while one person after another approached him, all wanting something. The company that built the aircraft he was in, an Airbus commercial airliner that was one of several owned by UNEF Command, wanted contracts to service and support humanity's new fleet of starships. Airbus was not alone. Every aerospace company on the planet wanted a piece of the action. Even during the flight from Geneva, ministers from two nations had presented arguments for why companies in their respective countries should be awarded lucrative contracts. Chang had listened and smiled and nodded, and reminded them that he did not have the final decision on contract awards. Being pestered by lobbyists even while he was trying to relax during a long flight made him jealous of Joe Bishop, who had commandeered a Panther dropship for his personal use. Chang thought that sent an arrogant signal of privilege, though he understood that Bishop was mobbed by crowds everywhere he went, and not all of those crowds were friendly. A dropship would have made the flight to New York in less than an hour, even with the necessity of adhering to airspace restrictions on both ends of the flight. Chang took a deep breath, disappointed that the flight was coming straight in from the ocean, depriving him of a view of the city. He would see it from the helicopter, of course. No need to rush. Turning to the aide he had rudely dismissed, he raised an eyebrow. The man shook his head. Whatever he wanted to say, it could wait for landing. A flight attendant came through the cabin to collect drink containers and check that seats were secured for landing. The attendant was a French Air Force captain by the wings on his uniform. Chang guessed he was also a pilot, part of the plane's relief crew. Amused when the captain glanced with awe at the merry band of pirates patch on Chang's own uniform, he flashed the man a smile.
"Air traffic control cleared us straight in," the man explained as the big jet's rate of descent increased. "We will be on the ground in 7 minutes." "You had best strap yourself in, Captain," Chang said with a well-practiced smile.
It took so little to make people happy, a tiny bit of his attention, a few words exchanged. Probably that evening the captain would be telling family and friends how he spoke with Senior Colonel Chang, yes, that Chang.
"It would not be."
His phone blared an alarm, following moments later by alarms of every phone aboard the plane. As he reached to pull a Z-phone from a pocket, his stomach was jolted by the jet pulling up sharply, the whine of the engines increasing in pitch as they spooled up. What the hell was happening? Above Chang's head and 4,000 kilometers to the northeast, there were multiple gamma-ray bursts as starships appeared suddenly. They emerged from their jump wormholes without warning, 600 kilometers over the ocean between Greenland and Iceland. None of the ship's crews took time to peer down at the water and ice below. To them, it was just another planet, another target. Ahead of the ships was their first target, a former Kristang troop transport now named the Yu Kishan. That ship, never a threat to any ship in the squadron, had only one reactor fired up, and it was surrounded by boxy structures that were either cargo or passenger pods. The attacking ships did not bother to scan the target to determine the purpose of the pods. They simply launched missiles, then followed up with maser cannons as their fire control sensors recovered from the jump distortion. The Yu Kishan was ripped apart by maser bolts cutting into and through its lightly armored skin. A mere second later, four missiles tore into the broken pieces, and the ship exploded, burning debris raining down into the atmosphere below. The warships continued onward, splitting up to attack secondary targets. Railgun magnets were energized as the ships curved over the horizon, seeking a view of the place they would strike first. A complex of buildings where their enemy had planned insidious attacks against those who owned and operated the ships. The United Nations headquarters in New York.
"Brace for impact!" the pilot shouted over the plane's intercom. "Brace! Brace! Brace!"
The big jet was slammed to the side, yawing to the left in the direction of the blast wave from the railgun impacts that had struck the east side of Manhattan. Before he tucked his head into his lap, Chang had seen a blindingly bright flash reflected on the plane's wing as something exploded with frightening force behind them. Immediately, the flight crew had put the plane into a hard turn, knowing that taking the blast wave from the back would be fatal. There was a shuddering that shook Chang's brain loose from his skull, accompanied by a shrieking and a long, low rumble, like distant thunder,
Only it didn't stop. Another bright flash. Another. Whoever the enemy was, they were pounding New York from orbit. Someone was screaming, and there was announcement over the intercom. He couldn't hear enough to make sense of it. The last flash faded away, along with the rumbling of endless thunder, and then there was an eerie silence. People were talking, their mouths moving. He couldn't hear. Neither could anyone else, apparently. They were communicating by sign language. From forward, the French Air Force captain stumbled down the aisle, bleeding from a cut on his forehead, and he was wearing a yellow inflatable life jacket. Chang rested his feet on the floor. The familiar vibration of the engines had ceased, and he could feel himself growing lighter as the plane went into a deep dive. Out the window, all he could see was steely blue water. The Atlantic Ocean. They were going down.